Yesterday we were in the middle of our discussion of biblical approaches to the questions of cultural symbols and meanings when we had to break off. So we'll pick up from there. But I wanted to read first a little something from this book, Virginia Carey Hudson, O Ye Jigs and Juleps. Are any of you familiar with it? You read? Dwayne's familiar with it. This is a girl, 6 years old, 9 years old, I guess, who has written her profound thoughts on everything in the universe. And this is what she has to say about missionaries. Missionaries are people who are Christians who try to make other people Christians too. They can't get people to come to church here and listen, so they go to China to see if the Chinese will come and listen. I bet they can't even talk like a Chinaman. A long trip for nothing, if you ask me. Actually, there's quite a bit of profundity to that, because we've been talking quite a bit about understanding a culture, which is another way of saying understanding a language, understanding a people's conceptual language, and the language of experience, and the language of life. And, of course, if a missionary can't understand the language of the Chinaman, if he can't understand the conceptual language of the people and the environment in which he is working, then we have seen, as some of you have given examples of how this then leads to an exporting of a particular range of cultural meanings and values that may or may not be the least bit appropriate or plug into the true meanings of the gospel in the setting in which a person is working. With that in mind, let's look again at how, at different times and different places, the people of our faith have grappled with this question. And the first example that we used yesterday was from Deuteronomy. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah could also fit into this general approach, where the understanding of the faith was culturally exclusive. The Hebrew people were told when they crossed into Cana to utterly destroy that culture and that civilization, to have nothing to do with the Canaanites whatsoever, and to certainly have nothing to do with their religious traditions. And then we looked at Ruth, which was quite a different model. The Moabites and the Israelites, and Ruth, a Moabitess, returning with her mother-in-law, and actively embracing a new people. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Just a much more universal kind of understanding. We mentioned, I think, right at the end, I can't remember quite where we broke off. Did we mention the parable of the Good Samaritan? Okay. Very quickly, there again, a man has come to Jesus and asked him, "What must I do to be saved?" And Jesus says, "Well, you know the commandments. What are they?" He responds to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. Very good. But who is the neighbor? Now you see we're trying to define the boundaries here of our faith and define the boundaries of our obligations and our actions, the boundaries of the ethical life, the boundaries within which we will be in God's community. And so Jesus tells the story of a situation in which it is a foreigner who is the one who proves to be neighborly. And Jesus turns the question around entirely. The original question, "Who is my neighbor?" And Jesus asks, after telling the story of the Good Samaritan, "Now which one of the three proved a neighbor to the man in need?" Radical transformation of the question, and a transformation which then embraced another people and another people's, yes, another people. Now let's look at the fifth chapter of Matthew. Does anyone have a Bible handy would like to read? Matthew 5. Verse 21. In fact, make that 21 and 22. Anyone like to read that?
You have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council, and whoever says you fool shall be liable to the hell of fire.
Okay. And someone else read 27 and 28.
You have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But now I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman and wants to possess her is guilty of committing adultery with her in his heart.
Okay, and 43 and 44. Anyone?
You have heard that it was said, love your friends, hate your enemies. But now I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you.
Okay. Look at the grammatical pattern here. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you. If we go back to 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. What Jesus is doing is he's picking up the powerful symbols, the powerful meanings of his culture, and he is turning them on their ear. He is utilizing them, but he is infusing them with a new meaning. In the same way that we saw yesterday that this symbol could mean at the end of World War II, it means victory, and in the early 60s, peace. Once it's a celebration of war, and another case it's an opposition to war. In the same way that the same symbol was turned around and infused with a new meaning, Jesus is doing that with the phrases and the meanings in the symbol life of his people. It raises kind of an interesting challenge for us, which we will try to do in a little bit. We might look at some of the powerful symbols and meanings in our society and see how what they mean in our present context and what we might do to turn them around in the same way. Now, if we stay right within this chapter of Matthew and look at verses 17 and 18, we find another and very interesting, different approach to culture. Someone like to read 17 and 18.
Do not think that I have come to do away with the law of Moses and the teachings of the prophets. I have not come to do away with them, but to make their teachings come true. 18.
Yes.
Remember that as long as heaven and earth last, not the least point or the smallest detail of the law will be done away with, not until the end of all things.
Now that's very interesting. He's not come to abolish the law and the traditions, but he has come to fulfill them. Do we have a difference in the approach to culture between this expression here and what we've seen in verses 21 and 43 and so on? How do you feel about that?
Well, it's the same thing. Jesus is using the given tradition as a building block for the new thing that he's doing.
And none of the law, not one iota, not one dot, is to pass away. That all of it will be fulfilled. Quite a bit different than what some of us feel in the face of secular culture and many missionaries have felt in the face of animistic societies and societies of other religions, where there was definitely not the feeling that we could affirm everything. In fact, much must be cut down and destroyed. Here, of course, Jesus is speaking within the tradition of the law, the Hebrew law. But notice that it's a theme of fulfillment, of completion of everything, of bringing the true meanings out of the law. We find the same thing in Luke. And in Luke chapter 4, verse 16, we find even a more complete program of what this fulfillment of the law means. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and he went to the synagogue, as his custom was on the Sabbath day, and he stood up to read. And there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." And he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the congregation were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Jesus himself is the fulfillment of the prophecy. Here again, it's interesting that Jesus didn't stand up in the synagogue and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to tell you who I am and what I'm here for." But there's the understanding that even as the Christ, he is the bringing into completion of all of the law and the prophets. And in a very specific and a very dramatic way, as he lifts up the preaching of good news to the poor, the release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, setting at liberty the oppressed, proclaiming acceptable year of the Lord, the ushering in of the kingdom today, here in our midst, in his midst.
In another section of the gospel, they also add this, that he spoke with authority in the synagogue there. So, I mean, even though he wasn't egotistical about it, it still carried weight.
Yes.
As against the authority of the law.
Right, right. Well, here we have examples of the way Jesus working within the tradition of the Jewish law is proclaiming its fulfillment. And I think from that we can, and since the early church remembered that and highlighted that, and the gospel's written many years later, at least 100 years after his birth, are reflecting the importance of those themes within their community and worship life. We then confront in the early church the problem, well, what happens outside of the Jewish community? How are we to understand Christ if he is the fulfillment of Jewish law? Then how are we to understand his relationship to Gentiles? Must they first become Jews? And of course, this was a major problem, as we all know, for the early church. It was a problem for Peter. And we've heard several times the story of Peter and Cornelius. Let's look at that a bit. It's in Acts 10. This, incidentally, is one of the more humorous stories, I think, in the New Testament. Luke is clearly making gentle fun of Peter and how much it took to convince Peter that it was quite all right for him to approach Cornelius. Cornelius had was a man of God, but he was also a Roman centurion, and he had received a vision of an angel commanding him to call for Peter and ask Peter for instruction in the faith. And so Cornelius, a man of considerable authority and influence, sends one, another soldier and two of his servants, a whole company of three ambassadors, to Peter, to ask Peter if he would be willing to come. Meanwhile, Peter receives a visitation from an angel too in the form of a vision. Who would like to read verses 9 through 16? Job, Acts 10, 9 through 16. Anyone pick up on that?
The next day, as they were on their journey and coming near the city, Peter went up on the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. And he became hungry and desired something to eat. While they were preparing it, he fell into a trance and saw the heaven opened and something descending like a great sheet, let down by four corners upon the earth. In it were all kinds of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. And came a voice to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said, "No, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean." And the voice came to him again a second time, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." This happened three times, and the thing was taken up at once to heaven.
Okay. Now, Peter didn't quite get the significance of that yet. When the messengers from Cornelius arrived at his house, asking him if he would come, and it took the Spirit again, had to intervene and tell Peter, it's all right, you can go with them. So, under their guidance, Peter does go, and he finally does visit Cornelius. Now, when Peter arrives, Cornelius falls down at his feet and worships him. Peter lifts him up, saying, "Stand up, I too am a man." And as he talked with them, he went in and said to them, now this is where I think Luke's humor reaches a peak. "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without objection. I asked then why you sent for me." How pompous. And yet, of course, the real gist of the story is right here, that Peter did respond to the prodding of the Spirit and did dine with Cornelius. And this is but one example of the way in which the faith had to be prodded to understand itself as being something much greater than and beyond simply the confines of Jewish law, but as a gospel that is a gospel for all people. Continuing, "And Peter opened his mouth and said, 'Truly I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him.'" Now, we Lutherans might argue with the concept of works righteousness here, but what I would like to lift up is it is the idea that it is not particularly the belief or the theological position, or the church membership, the religious adherence that is of interest to Peter, but it is those who fear God and do what is right. It is a matter of behavior and attitude. And behaviors and attitudes can be quite universal. They're not tied down to particular symbols, are they? One can have certain attitudes and one can undertake certain behaviors which may fit under a rubric of Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam or animism. And then, with this type of approach to culture, one then finds that there are also symbols within the Christian faith which can be identified with those attitudes and behaviors and then evoke an understanding of what the gospel means in those contexts. My wife repeats what her father often used to say. Her father was a Christian. But her father used to say that the finest Christian he ever met was their driver, who incidentally was a Muslim. And there was no conflict there. Finally, let's look at one other example of this biblical interaction with culture in Acts 17. Verses 22 and 23. Would someone like to read that? Acts 17, 22, 23.
standing in the middle of the Areopagus said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship is unknown. This I proclaim to you."
Isn't that a marvelous, marvelous passage? One of the curious things here is that Paul is not trying to force a new symbol system upon them, or a new idea upon them, or even a new language upon them. He's lifting up what they already have. He said, "This unknown God that you already worship, this I proclaim to you." What I also find fascinating about this is to think about what that altar to the unknown God must have been among the people in Athens. Do you think it was their largest and greatest altar? Do you think it would be really important in their religious life? Probably very minor.
Just in case they left any out.
Just in case. That's the whole concept. It's the crumbs on the plate. It's the stone that the builder rejected. It's the refuse, the leftover. And it is the refuse and the leftover. It's the most insignificant of gods that Paul lifts up and says, "This is what I proclaim to you and invite you to understand as the Lord of all creation." So there's another key for how we might approach other cultures and thinking not only internationally but also within our own country, in terms of discovering that which is truly representative of what the cross of Christ is to us. Yes.
What was the history? Was that very successful in Athens? I remember, I think, hearing one time. My thought was it didn't catch on very well. Was that?
I believe you're right. I think they kicked him out soon after that.
Okay.
That's true.
So it was a good attempt, but for some reason that bridge never got built.
Quite possibly, because the concept is a very difficult one. It is very close to what the real scandal of the cross is. And that those who would embrace that and affirm that are those who would probably understand the foolishness of worshiping a God whose son was killed in the way that Christ was.
And the Athenians probably would have been probably the most opposite of that of most of the places. Called.
Very much. Very much. Yes.
But good in point. Mission work, either at home or abroad, the Lord has never said go out and succeed. It says go. And like Boniface that I mentioned yesterday, and like the men before Namundsen there, maybe it didn't start, but a seed was sown. Mm-hmm. And it had to be a new beginning. But that's Christianity itself.
Right. You don't evaluate their work based on the success that occurred or didn't occur later. Right.
The very ending of the story identifies the typical of each of these encounters. So Paul left them, and some men joined him and believed. Among them was Dionysius, who was very important for the early Christian community, a member of the council. There was also a woman named Demarius and some other people. And so the seed took root. You know, he didn't maybe flower in a big plant, but it was there.
Mm-hmm.
Like China, you know, we just thought Christianity had left China when the revolution came, and today we're seeing the evidences of the seed that's been lying dormant, maybe not so dormant, we don't know.
Right. Cool. Well, let's look a little bit at the changes in the understanding of mission, particularly in terms of the way it has been conducted. We've been talking these last few days about the realm of ideas, and the realm of faith and theology and so on. And let's look at some of the actual practical considerations that have gone into the development of missions, because we are now in a new era. We're in a transition period, I think, in and the understanding of the mission activity of the church. And it's a rather exciting one. It's one in which what is going to emerge is definitely not set in stone, and there's a great deal of opportunity for discussion as to what we ought to be doing, where we're going from here. David Vickner, who until last year was the executive director of the Division for World Mission and Ecumenism of the LCA, has written a little paper briefly outlining a three-stage conceptual scheme for the history of missions, and I think that is worth worth looking at. Many of the other churches are sharing this particular type of vision, so it's become quite common parlance to talk about mission as being in any given area as being in stage one or stage two or stage three. No one yet is talking about stage four that I know of. I wrote to the DWME just before coming up here to see if there were any further developments since this, and I got an interesting letter back saying none of us have started talking about stage four yet. But if we think of mission as being in more or less, of course, there's always been a great mission emphasis and a great mission dimension to the church ever since Pentecost, which we can really see as the beginning of mission. However, the really dramatic explosion of mission activity occurred in the 19th century when the European and American churches were also undergoing a very strong spiritual revival. And a great deal of the concept of mission then was centered on the acceptance of Jesus' command to preach the gospel to all nations. And that was taken very seriously and very literally. And so missionaries have been sent by churches throughout Europe and America, throughout the entire world. In fact, I think it's fairly safe to say today that probably every nation in the world has had the church, or at least Christians, planted it in one form or another today. So there's been a fulfillment of that dream in a very short span of time. But the initial stages of this, and actually we can see this as a process that extended from the early part of the 19th century right on through to World War II, focused upon the activity of the missionary. The missionaries were almost exclusively sent from Europe and America to other countries. And they were involved in a three-part activity of preaching, teaching, and healing. Despite the wide diversity of churches that were involved in sending missionaries, there was a great deal of theological uniformity and consensus among missionaries throughout the world as to what it was they were doing, why they were doing it, where their commandment lay, the absolute authority of the scripture, and the absolute uniqueness of the Christian faith. And this is why we saw when we were talking about the Batak's experience with foreign missionaries, how wave after wave of missionary could not perceive any value at all within the animistic traditions, but felt that it was critical that those traditions be opposed in order to maintain the purity of the Christian faith. And we also discussed how the theological emphasis of this whole period of time, although it showed many variations, was on personal salvation.